where the earth heaves up in stony surges, leaving behind valleys streaked with silver. The call is for dogs and people with tough bodies, iron stamina, and strong character. In the high country, human contact is sparse, so livestock are touchy, scrub is dense, and there are plenty of places to hide. Terrain is rough, the weather is unpredictable. Quiet days with limpid sunshine turn vicious with driving freezing winds and fog and snow and rain. Dog handlers need all their guile, for the potential of tragedy is great.
A Mountain Man and His Shaggy Dogs, a profile of Rusty Connolly by Angela Good. Above the Balloka Valley in the Bunambra district of the Victorian High Country, Rusty Connolly lives the life that has made a legend of mountain cattlemen. Every year before the snows arrive, he has to bring his cattle down off leasehold country 4,500 feet up in the Alpine National Park. His leasehold adjoins Tom Grogan Station, that sacred site of folklore immortalised by Banjo Paterson in The Man from Snowy River in 1895. This was where Jack Riley did his epic ride up Leather Barrel Creek, which feeds into the River Murray. With his homebred Australian stock horses and four dogs, 55-year-old Rusty, who's been in the high country all his life, heads off up the mountains for 3 or 4 days at a time. High up in the great dividing range among the snow gums, running streams, rocks and fallen logs, Rusty Connolly couldn't muster his cattle unless he had a team of good dogs. "You've got to use dogs in the mountains," he says. "It's scrubby, rough and steep. Some of it is one in one gradient. In fact, good dogs are even more essential up here than good horses." The dogs which accompany him belie their looks. They are, in Rusty's words, not a pretty sight, and they make terrible pets. "They are hard-working dogs," says Rusty, "great at finding cattle in this rough country. And they are faithful, hardy and tireless. They are so tough, they sleep quite happily out in the snow. But they are not sociable dogs. They don't like being petted or fussed over." So off they go. Rusty, with his Akubra on the red head that gave him his name, oilskin, chaps, warm sweater and thick socks, sitting deeply in his stock saddle with pack horses and dogs, picking their way over wombat holes and rocks to scout 10,000 acres through his Hereford. When he gets to the hut where he'll camp, he spells his team, checks his holding yards, and prepares for the following day's muster. At dawn, he takes two dogs and leaves two behind. As he searches for cattle tracks in the dense scrub, he also keeps a close eye on his dogs. They'll tell him when there are cattle nearby. Their noses poking through that shaggy mat sniff the air, and if the scent is promising, the dogs walk in its direction. They cast wide and flush out animals toward the horsemen. Some Smithfield cross dogs, Rusty says, are forceful and give the beasts a quick nip, but mostly they work quietly. If they do bark, it is with a relatively soft voice. Rusty remembers with fondness many great dogs over the years, but especially Biff, who could track and scent cattle and handle up to 100 head on his own. Rusty and the others who graze the Alpine runs are not just battling a failing rural economy, they are struggling to retain their Alpine leaseholds. "Claims that the cattle are damaging the mountains are nonsense," says Rusty and other members of the Mountain Cattlemen's Association. "Log trucks and four-wheel drive vehicles do far more damage and bring in weeds. Cattle don't do damage, and they help with fire control by keeping the grasses down. If anything, the mountains are understocked, says this quiet man who has seen 41 summers come and go on the alpine runs. He rides away among the broadleaf peppermint, the black sally in the creeks, and the snow gums twisting on the slopes. The shaggy dogs that will help move about 200 cattle into the lower country in the next few weeks lope behind him, sniffing the leaf-scented air for work waiting to be done.
This one's called Claws Like a Wombat, from Bruce Rogers at Mirrawa in New South Wales. Our son picked Max up as a pup while he was a jackaroo on Gunbar Station in the Riverina. When he went off to work in the US, Max was left with us along with a brown mare that had not been long broken in. As a working dog, Max, who was jet black and with mad, staring eyes, got about 3 points out of 100, but he was a hell of a character. Energy abounded. You couldn't wear him down, but his energies were all at the wrong time and place. One of the things our son had taught Max when he was a pup was to hop up on the pommel of the saddle. He became clever at it. You only had to look at Max and he'd be up on the saddle with you. Although we didn't get much work out of Max, we had a brown mare going quite well at this stage, although she was still pretty touchy. She'd just learnt to stand at a gate while you leaned over and opened it. And that was when Max performed his most woeful deed. The mare was stationary. Max thought he was a little tired, so he decided to jump on board. I saw the look in his eye all too late. "No, Max, no, get away, you black animal!" There was no stopping him. He didn't quite make the saddle and had to claw his way up the mare's shoulder. The mare took off, through the gate, head down, ears back, me yelling, and Max clawing on for dear life. He had claws like a wombat. No amount of pushing and swiping would free him. Half a mile we went like this, a terrified mare, a more terrified rider, and a black dog enjoying the whole business. Max was at last dispatched from the saddle at about 30 miles an hour. He was not only exuberant, he was also very tough. He bounced 3 times, got up and running, and barked at the horse's heels for good measure.
"If I live, I'm going to kill you, Max,"
I said between gasps for air and through clenched teeth while we galloped on flat out. Well, I didn't kill him. And a relationship persisted with that dog for a long time. Whenever you felt like throttling him, he'd come up and look at you lovingly with those steery eyes and offer you his paw to shake hands. That always broke me right up. So Max would save himself a hiding, and everyone would go away in stitches.
Mountain Saviour by Margaret Weston from Nimitabelle, New South Wales. A good working dog is a wonderful asset, but if he also happens to be your best mate and saviour, then he's priceless. My story is set back in the 1950s, high in the snowy mountains above Jindabyne. Our neighbours used to lease land in the mountains where they grazed sheep during summer, a practice not allowed these days, which still raises the hackles of many mountain people. At the time, my brother Jimmy was a boy of 12, and so proud when our parents agreed that he could go to the mountains and help with the muster. He felt really grown up being part of such an assignment. My father's best dog, Ring, was to be his helpmate, as Ring was reputed to have more brains than Jimmy and knew twice as much about everything. Our mother, a descendant of the Pendergasts, who were pioneers of the mountain, had prepared Jimmy for the trip and warned him of the dangers that he might encounter and how to overcome them. However, during a heavy fog, Jimmy lost his bearings, became completely disoriented, and failed to rendezvous with the other musterers. Ring stayed by his side, and Jimmy said his presence gave him confidence and subdued his immediate panic. At nightfall, they sought out a hollow log and both crawled in. Although the temperature dropped dramatically that night, Wing's body kept Jimmy warm. Jimmy said his short life flashed before him. He could imagine his father wailing, "Mary, I've got 10 more kids, but only one dog as good as that one." Jimmy was my twin brother and one of 11 children in the family. Next morning, the majestic mountains were bathed in sunshine, and Jimmy was rescued after an all-night search on foot and horseback. Ring was revered in our family after this incident and was assured of a pampered retirement. My mother always believed he saved Jimmy's life by providing body warmth throughout that freezing night in the mountains.
Far from the bitumen and streetlights lives a breed of dogs and people who share the qualities of our pioneers. They survive without mollycoddling, without doctors or vets, without shops and theatres. Through such close bonds, a dog will risk its life to save its master, as did the Arnold's pig dog in Queensland.
Salute to a Hero, written by Barbara Arnold from Goulgworth, South Australia. When we lived in far north Queensland, we kept 3 Rhodesian Ridgeback Red Heeler dogs for culling wild pig numbers for station owners. Pigs were a terrible menace up there. They would tear down fences, eat the cows' feed, kill calves, and savage people if they got a chance. My husband was a truck driver at a wolfram mine 50 miles from Mareeba. Most weekends we would head off along the riverbanks where the rubber vines grew so densely that they created hollows where pigs would hide. My husband would drive and the children, Shane and Deanne and I, would keep a lookout. The 3 dogs would lean out, sniffing the air, and as soon as they picked up a scent, they would jump off the vehicle and run in its direction. We would follow on foot until the dogs had located the pigs and bailed them up in a rubber tree hollow. They would then distract the pigs to prevent them charging at my husband as he came in close with his gun. Some people taught their dogs to bite the ankles of pigs, but my husband taught ours to stand back and distract them so he could aim and shoot without having the pigs turn on him. The biting type of dogs, because they came in close, often got gored and killed. Since our dogs were also our friends, we didn't like to make them take too many risks. One weekend when we'd just shot a mountain dingo, we spotted a huge boar disappearing into the scrub. My husband grabbed the 222 we keep in the Toyota all the time and went after him on foot, followed by Shane, who was then 12. We lost the trail in the dense rubber vine, just as my husband was bending down in the riverbed, looking into the scrub at a level with the bank. The boar came charging at him. He didn't have time to fire before he was knocked over backwards, smashing the gun barrel on Shane's head. A hole was gouged in my husband's elbow, and he grazed his knee. Before he knew what had happened, the pig was standing over him, ready to rip open his stomach. I was watching all this from a distance and was frozen with terror. Suddenly, in a flash of red, Sam, the big male dog, appeared from nowhere, grabbed the pig's flank, turned him away from my husband, and distracted him. My husband was then able to quickly find his gun. He fired all the bullets remaining in it and killed the pig. We regrouped after that close call, checked all the injuries, and bound up Shane's head with my skirt. He later had to have stitches. Very shaken by the experience, we made our way back to the Toyota and when we got home, we gave Sam an extra serve of dinner to reward him for his loyalty. Without doubt, my husband would have been killed had the dog not charged in when he did. The feat was all the more remarkable since the dogs had been trained not to bite, yet Sam had recognised a time when he should.
This one we've called The Fortunes of Festival Frank. It was written by Pauline Smart from Port Augusta in South Australia. I used to suspect that it was only the good dogs that met an early death. Since knowing Frank, I'm convinced this is so. Frank was given to my husband at 10 weeks of age as a replacement for a dog that had died from snakebite. A good dog, of course. Frank was pure black, had an undershot jaw and an unquenchable spirit. As time went by, he developed a light-hearted approach to life and work that no amount of discipline could discourage. It wasn't that he was idle, it was just that he didn't feel as though he should take things too seriously. However, he'd also developed an uncanny ability to realise when to display just enough talent to keep him from that celestial paddock where all sheep have wings. One day, my husband was trying to draft some ewes ready to truck, and he was running late, largely because Frank was his offsider. Ears pricked, pointed snout skywards and tail up jauntily, Frank had rushed about barking at the birds, showing no interest in the sheep. The heat, the dust and the tempers were all rising as the truck pulled up and the driver got out. He jumped the fence to lend a hand, but from somewhere up behind the sheep he could hear a continuous yapping and caught glimpses of a very enthusiastic black dog. A thick haze of dust obscured the total picture. Once the sheep were loaded, the truckie commented, "Not a bad dog he got there." A whistle brought Frank, expecting praise, bouncing up into my husband's arms, and greatly appreciating the weight being taken off his feet. Without a word, my husband walked over to the truck, opened the door, and put Frank in. "He's yours. He's yours," he said, throwing in Frank's chain for good measure. The truckie was a bit suspicious of the haste with which Frank was given away, but my husband muttered something about needing a paddock dog rather than a yard dog. The last I saw of Frank, he had his paws on the dashboard, ears pricked, eyes bright, tail wagging, and he was grinning widely at his new associate, happily unaware of the consequences had he not opted for a career change. A few years later, we were at my in-law's property a couple of hundred kilometres away, helping in the yards, when a truck pulled up to load some wieners. I recognised the driver, and there was absolutely no mistaking the black dog with the pointed snout and the festival attitude. He was still barking at birds, and didn't seem to have developed a more thoughtful outlook on life at all. Maybe one day Frank will turn out to be a good working dog, or maybe one day his luck will just run out. In the meantime, Frank is sporting a shiny new registration disc and can continue to pursue his life of pleasure with just the right amount of shrewd judgment thrown in.
The horizon shimmers in the hazy, dusty distance. It's hot. The trees are sparse. From the wooden veranda and its low, overhanging roof, you hear a windmill creak and gates clank. In far-off runs, measured in square miles rather than acres, hardy merinos graze saltbush and bluebush. Muster them and they'll run like stags. They'll split, they'll sit down, they'll hide. Station dogs need to be cunning and tough and fast. Their feet get prickles and are cut by rocks. Troughs and dams are far apart. The shade is thin. In the yards where the mobs are drafted at shearing time, urgent yaps of the yard dog pierce through the indignant complaints of ewes and falsetto-voiced lambs. On the big stations, shearing will go on for months. 8 shearers working flat out, rouseabouts sweeping the board, tossing fleeces and keeping pens full for each shearer. Dogs get little rest in the shed and the yards, and it helps if they can use their initiative. Who although sometimes they go overboard. There are dangers and diseases. And some dogs, like Soda, end up looking like a hard-boiled egg.
This one we've called a hard-boiled egg Soda from Garth Faraga at Little Hartley in New South Wales. In North Queensland's Longreach Winton area during 1951, I had a black and tan sheepdog named Soda. He was a Kelpie Collie cross with a lovely thick coat of not very long hair. Following the advice of a local man, I treated Soda with mutton fat and kerosene for small brown dog ticks. Although I followed the recipe carefully, the treatment was far too severe and removed all the hair from his body, leaving him totally devoid of any covering. Soda was a pathetic sight, but nothing could keep the smile from his face. He was a very happy, hard-working dog with plenty of spirit. As I wanted to work him at shearing time, I made him a little sugar bag coat to keep the sun from burning his bald back. One morning, we brought sheep to the yards at the shearing shed, and I removed his little coat and tied him under a shady tree at the shed. After lunch, I rode out in the 110-degree heat to get a small mob of sheep that had been missed about 2 miles from the shed. I left Soda tied up in the shade and took another dog to work the sheep. Soda slipped out of his collar and followed me. He reached me just after I got to the sheep. This meant I had a problem. How to get Soda to the shed without getting him burnt and blistered by the sun? It was a good season and there was water in a nearby creek, so I coated his back with brown black mud and covered the mud with dry grass, and we made it back okay. By this time, though, the mud had dried and it cracked off his back, leaving him looking like a hard-boiled egg fresh from its shell, with every vestige of dried skin removed. One of the shearers said his hair would not grow properly again, but in about 2 weeks he had a lovely new coat of crisp hair.
Winning Over the Rival, written by Betty Thompson from Bylong, New South Wales. When I married 43 years ago and came to live with my husband, I felt everything was perfect, and the love we had for each other was sublime. Alas, I never dreamt I would have to fight for that love with a dog for 2 years and be treated with such dislike. Ginny was my rival right from the very first day I took up my position as a loving wife. She was my husband's shadow and obedient servant, following at his heels wherever he went. There was some doubt about her breeding, but she showed a mixture of cattle and sheepdog in her appearance, and in her ability to work both cattle and sheep. She was really good to watch, biting as directed by my husband, either just the nip or really good bite, first one heel and then the other, but she never bit the sheep and was quite handy in the yards as well. Several months after I married, she still eyed me off with suspicion and would have nothing to do with me. Even when it came to her feed time, she would not accept it from me and would wait until I was out of sight before she very gingerly ate it with distaste. If my husband put his arms around me, she would slink off and refuse to follow us another step. Having lived on the land all my life, I was accustomed to animals and the work associated with them. Naturally, I helped with all the outside work when needed, and especially with the stock. One day I went to help with the muster, and as my own horse was lame, my husband caught one of his horses for me to ride. Normally it was Ginny's habit to spin and bark with excitement, then rush off ahead of us as we mounted. This day, however, I was about halfway onto the horse. Ginny unwound, and as quick as a flash, darted in with all her pent-up hatred, bit my horse on the front foot. Well, you can just imagine the result. My poor horse let out a wild snort, leapt in the air, and at the same time spun sideways. How I managed to land in the saddle remains a mystery to this very day. When I finally quietened my horse and abused the dog, she smirked back at me as if to say, I got you that time. Her jealousy went on for almost 2 years, and I'd given up trying to win her over. Then, on one occasion, we had a bad outbreak of bushfires, and my husband and all the available men had to be on the job both day and night, while I was left at home to cope with the chores. Ginny was left at home with me, and her spirits reached rock bottom. She went into deep mourning for her master and true love, staying put in her kennel. About the third day, though, she actually followed me to the shed and watched me pick up the fleeces and throw them on the table and sweep the board. Now and again I gave her a pat and said, "Cheer up, old girl, he'll be home soon." Each time there was a small response from her, just a slight wag of the tail, but it was the first ever, and I began to wonder what would happen next. On the fourth day, she began following me, and when I picked up a fleece, she would pick up a piece of wool, bring it back to the table and drop it at my feet as if to say, "There, I'm helping too." I would tell her she was a good dog and get a big tail wag. By the end of the week, she was keeping close tabs on my every move. She came to help me start the engine to run the generator for our lights at night. As I cranked the motor, she would rush in and bark at the handle until it started. Then she would sit down and look at me with her head on one side as if to say, "There, that helped you get it going, didn't it?" The final capitulation came when she followed me to bed and slept outside the door all night. I knew at last I was accepted, but I did wonder if she would change when my husband returned. It was a great surprise that when he finally arrived, exhausted and smelling of smoke and gum leaves, and took me in his arms, she barked her approval and jumped up and licked first him, then me. I had at last won the day, and she was willing to share her master with me forever.
This one we've called Backing the Blockage, from Frank Borden at Tumby Bay in South Australia. Friend, share farmer and shearer Andrew Mills comes from a family of noted Kelpie breeders, owners and trainers. Accordingly, he had a particularly good dog called Boy. During shearing, we were filling the shed from outside when the sheep balked in one of the catching pens. Andrew sent Boy up onto the backs of the wethers, up the ramp and into the shed to look for the blockage. Unbeknown to us, my brother Bernie, who was the shed hand and who was big and hairy, was bending down, nailing the grating in the catching pen into place. Boy, true to form, darted over the backs of the sheep and landed with a big whoop right onto Bernie's broad back. It's still debatable today who got the bigger shock. Bernie leapt into the air and shouted obscenities, whilst Boy must have been suffering considerably from shock also. We spectators had considerable difficulty controlling our mirth. This one's called Orders from On High, written by Natalie Broad from Kew in Western Australia. Fred was a little rough-coated Kelpie dog belonging to Eric, my brother-in-law. He was top dog of the seven we had at the time, but very definitely a one-man dog who worshipped the ground Eric walked on. I have a funny little story to tell about Fred during mustering time 5 years ago. Eric flies a plane, so Jenny, the Jillaroo, who was working with us at the time, decided to take Fred because she'd seen how useful he was. She thought he'd be able to help out. We have an 800,000-acre sheep station in the Murchison, so we travel a lot of miles, especially at mustering time. Eric directed Jenny onto a large mob of towie sheep, which started to go in about 10 different directions, so she screamed and signalled to Fred, "Get back there!" All he'd do was run along next to the motorbike, waiting to jump on for a free ride. He wasn't going to work for her. According to Fred, he only had one master, and it definitely wasn't Jenny. Eric flew over again to see that Jenny was still having difficulty trying to control her mob, and asked her over the mustering radio, which was attached to the front of the bike, what the matter was. She tried to explain her plight. The other musterers were too far away to come and assist, plus they had mobs of their own to control. The only option was for Fred to lift his game. Jenny called Fred back to the bike, and Eric whistled into the radio and told Fred to get back round there. Fred shot off the back of the bike like a bullet and did what he knows best. Jenny stared in amazement at this extraordinary little dog, who, after taking orders from his boss in the air, had the mob under control in no time at all.
Swirling dust, beasts roaring like an angry football crowd. Yards with fortress fences, the crack of stop whips and the drumbeat of hooves. These are the essence of cattle country. Shiny-coated cattle herded by helicopter. Horse and dog jostle and bellow and always await that moment to revolt. Dogs with jaws like rabbit traps eye them, alert to the slightest hint of insurrection. Bred to cope with droughts and long distances between waterholes, Australian cattle are some of the world's toughest. To tackle a cow fiercely protecting her calf, or a wild scrub bull takes guts. The dogs of the cattle country also have to be tough-footed. And if they're going to survive, fit, intelligent and agile. It's not all grime and sweat, though. Out of the dust comes the unexpected hilarious moments, such as the time the emus ruined the muster.
Dances with Emus, written by Kathy Boyden from Charters Towers, Queensland. I live about 2 hours out of Charters Towers in northern Queensland on Moonlight Creek Station. I'm 11 and do correspondence lessons through the Charters Towers Distance Education Centre. On one of those typical Aussie working days in the bush, my sister Jodie, 12, and I were allowed to take time off school to join in a muster for Mickey Bulls. It took a while for Dad to get all the kids and workers saddled up. The men were really looking forward to getting stuck into chasing the bulls, and everyone was impatient. Probably keenest of the lot, though, were our eager working dogs, led by Dad's dog, Ned. Even though they were often called the useless mongrels, no mustering gang would be complete without them. Finally, everyone was settled and ready, so off we went on a hard day's work. It was a day we were always to look back on and have a really good laugh about, although at the time, Granddad and the other men didn't see the funny side of things. We had finally mustered a herd of scrub cattle together, and all the troublesome mix had settled down to a make-believe peacefulness when suddenly we had visitors. The first we knew of this was when our working dogs, who'd been taking a breather under the shady tree, sat up with a start and pricked up their ears. Of course, Ned, the boss dog, couldn't resist the fun of a chase on a hot day. So off he dashed, with bristles sticking up a mile high and that awful bark of his that always sets Dad in a bad mood. All the commotion was over just a few inquisitive emus who'd seen the mob of cattle and the ringers and had decided to join them. Of course, Ned had other ideas that unfortunately didn't come true. The poor emus who'd almost reached the cattle were suddenly being mustered up by Ned and the black mates in his clan. But you all know that emus can't be made to do what they don't consider dignified, so instead of running away so that Ned could have his bit of sport, the frightened emus turned in a semicircle and headed straight for the mob, with Ned and his team hot on their tails. For the next 10 minutes there was one mighty commotion, what with emus flat out through the mob of cattle and the useless mongrels right behind them. The dogs were letting out such a howl and whine that you can imagine what happened to that mob of cattle. I can tell you those mixed didn't hang around to see the fun. By this time the emus had had enough and decided to give the dogs a bit of a fright. So they screeched to a halt, did a tight circle and darted straight for the dogs. Ned, despite being such a brainy dog, couldn't even guess what was in store for him. With a snarl and a brave bark, he stood his ground, but, honking as loud as thunder, the emus advanced with deadly intent. You should have seen those dogs with tails between their legs, head straight for the horses. Ned, however, was the oldest and slowest of the lot, and he wasn't quick enough to escape the kick of the leading emu's powerful legs or the cruel peck of his beak. The rest of the dogs found sanctuary under the horses' bellies. Until this time, the men on their horses had enjoyed the spectacle of the dogs and emus and had been laughing their heads off. But all of a sudden, they found themselves caught up in the turmoil too. What with dogs and emus running around the horses and the horses starting to have a good buck, there wasn't much peace and quiet. The men were yelling at the dogs to shoot through way out yonder, while the emus were stomping their feet to the beat of a drum. The dogs, meanwhile, were cringing on the ground like cowards. Just when the chaos was at its height, the emus turned and strutted away with necks held high, never to be seen again. When the men had finally controlled their horses and discovered that their mob of cattle had disappeared completely, their tempers were up pretty high. Dad needed something to take his fury out on, so his keen eye roved around for the instigator of all the mischief. But Ned, the trusty, hard-working pack leader, was nowhere in sight, and he stayed invisible for quite a few hours. No one had ever said he was brainless. The Bull Rider's Taboo, written by Errol Munt, Toowoomba, Queensland. This story happened some 15 years ago and involved Gundy, a cattle dog I'd been given as a pup by my uncle, Mr. Norm Ehrlich. I was on horseback, and Gundy and I were trying to shift a Droughtmaster bull across the highway to the yards on the other side. We almost had him enclosed in the yard when he decided to break away and head back across the highway, which was about 250 metres away. The determined bull gathered speed and took no notice of either the horse or Gundy as we tried to block him. When he reached the first road fence, he leapt across the grid and over the highway and then smashed through a piping gate on the other side. By then, I suppose he thought he was home and safe. This was not the case, as Gundy and I were in hot pursuit. The language from me was blue with rage, and Gundy was heeling him every step he took. By the time I opened the gate at the first fence and got across the highway, I could see the bull heading for the supposed safety of a dam. After a brisk gallop to catch Gundy and the bull, I arrived to see the bull make a leap into the dam. Gundy duly followed. In the next 20 seconds, I changed from being extremely angry to laughing so much that I couldn't sit straight on the horse. Imagine seeing your dog swim up alongside a bull, climb upon his shoulders, stand there on all fours and bite the bull on the back of the neck. A bull-riding dog. I hadn't seen that before. Deciding the water was no longer the best place to be, the bull swam to the edge of the dam with the dog still aboard. Then he climbed up the bank and stopped some 3 metres away from the water. At this stage, Gundy jumped off. He had ridden his 8 seconds and got top points from the judge.
The big sheep and cattle droves are a thing of the past. But that doesn't mean that the dogs of the bush don't keep travelling. They hit the track and search for their masters. They keep a weary truckie, the modern drover, company in the front seat as the miles roll by. And they also ride pillion on a motorbike like the best of the Hell's Angels. And there are those who really seem to have a brain, like the little red Kelpie dog from Nambour in Queensland.
This one we've called Healing Instinct on Hold, written by Les Evans from Borden in Western Australia. Many give credit to dogs that is not strictly justified. Dogs work after training and repetition. However, there are some who seem to have a brain. When I was a boy, we had a little red Kelpie bitch. She was the only heeler with horses and cattle we ever owned. On this occasion, my father was doing some fence repairs along a little used road. He had two horses standing unattended on the road, hitched to a wagon. They would do this indefinitely, but on this day, a limb broke off a tree and startled them. Away they went. When Dad saw Lassie take off after them, he thought, "Oh, well, that's that. I won't see the horses for a while. The wagon could break up and I'll have to walk home." However, instead of heeling the horses, as she always previously had done, Lassie went to one of the horses' head and bit and barked until she had them jammed up against the fence. When Dad finally got to them, Lassie was jumping up and down and her tail was thrashing happily. She'd caught them, and she was very pleased with herself. It really was quite an extraordinary act, since it was such a significant departure from a normal method of working. She'd overruled her natural instinct to heel the horses in order to stop them. That seems to me to be using brain power.
Sitting Pillion with the Postie, written by Helen Firth from Nambour, Queensland. Jet was a highly strung black kelpie of ours that spent many an hour running beside a horse or riding Pillion on a bike. She was an excellent working dog and devoted to her master. Many years ago, my husband and I went on a working holiday. We took Jet and her daughter Scooby, whose father had been a bull terrier. We decided to work in Brisbane for a couple of months. So we moved into a caravan park in Hawthorne, on the banks of the Brisbane River. The caravan park wouldn't allow the dogs to stay there, even though we promised faithfully that they would not be a problem and would stay tied up whenever we weren't there. Next door to the caravan park was a shipbuilding yard, so we approached the people there and asked if it would be okay to tie the dogs there. The next afternoon, when we went to take them for a run, we heard the following story. City people, being what they are, couldn't resist feeling sorry for the dogs. So while the men were sitting about at smoko break, they decided to let them have a run and some scraps. Scooby didn't leave their side because of the attraction of the food, but Jet, being the highly strung type, decided to have a sniff about the yards. She then heard the sound of a motorbike. Actually, it was the postie delivering mail. Something must have twigged in her mind and made her think it was her master. So off she went, running after him. A few of the employees started after her on foot. She led them a merry chase through the streets of Hawthorne before she managed to spring up on the bike with the postie, who hadn't been aware he was being chased. Imagine his amazement to be going along, quietly delivering mail, and suddenly to find a strange dog sitting Pillion on his bike.
This one's called A Chord of Understanding, written by H.H.K. from Coonabarabran in New South Wales. First appearances were not promising, but I was desperate. Next day, I was starting work as boss musterer at Portland Downs on the Barcoo. It was a place of 250,000 acres, and I had no dog. What was worse, I had sandy blight and couldn't see more than 150 yards. The dog, called Binky, was slate-grey in colour, dejected in appearance, and his ears were blocked and swollen by a massive infestation of blood-sucking ticks. Nevertheless, he greeted me gamely, wagging his tail, if not with enthusiasm, then at least with courtesy. "Yeah," I said, "I'll take him. I thought we might just make a team. He could hardly hear, and I could hardly see." That was the inauspicious start to a friendship that lasted for 8 years. It stretched from the Gibber Plains of central Queensland to the high hills of the Hunter Valley and beyond. And what a team we made. I never had a better mate, four-legged or two, while Blinky had a boss who knew and loved him for what he was, the best, gamest kelpie ever bred on the Western Plains. Once cared for, his coat was shiny. And go, that dog could outwork the rest of the dogs in the camp and leave them belly deep in the board reins. By the time Binky was 2 years old, I was the envy of the stock camp. Years passed. I left central Queensland and crossed the border into the southwest of New South Wales. Binky and I hitched a ride on a cattle truck down to the Hunter Valley. Barsham, a steep property in the mountain slopes of the Hunter, was a massive contrast to the plains of Queensland. What a challenge for the poor dog. But I needn't have worried. Once he'd mastered the art of lifting his leg on a slippery slope, he had no problems. Instinctively, he worked wider, always blocking the cunning, paddock-wise weather, never panicking the ewes and lambs. Again the years passed, and we were still inseparable. Only the scenery was different. Now the cliffs and rugged ranges of Arizona on Upper Maules Creek in the Manila district replaced the green Hunter Hills. In dog terms, Binky was getting on in years. He was worn by the hot Queensland sun and frozen by the cold nights of the mountains. But what a mate. He was always waiting as I tightened the girth straps, though now he trotted an inch behind the heels of my horse and left the younger dogs to cast ahead. One morning, Binky didn't answer my whistle. I found him, stiff as a board, under the saddle rack. 30 years have passed, and I still dream about that dog that shared my mustering years.